We're going to talk this morning about how we see the world and how the world is not necessarily what we see or hear or smell. Well, it is and it isn't. Dr. Ashley Ward is Professor of Animal Behaviour at the University of Sydney and the author of The Social Lives of Animals. He studied creatures great and small on travels that have ranged from the Serengeti Plains in Africa to the Antarctic Ocean. His inquisitive explorations began in the fields and streams of Yorkshire in northern England, and he's been looking at the planet through different eyes ever since. Ashley's new book is called Sensational, A New Story of Our Senses. Good morning, Dr. Ward.
Good morning.
We take our senses for granted, sight, smell, hearing, but we may not realise how many we have.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah, and well, I guess there are two things there. Yeah, we absolutely take our senses for granted. Until that is, we start to lose one or other. That could be old age or any number of different things. But layered on top of the five that we all know about, there are many, many others that really all contribute enormously to our quality of life. So it's important to think about those two, I think.
In a previous book of yours, The Social Lives of Animals, you wrote about the rich inner lives of krill in the oceans and how we could learn from them in the way we try and organise our own species. Can we start small? You've studied krill quite a bit. Can you tell us why and what you discovered?
Well, there's all sorts of things to krill, actually. They seem to be the most unprepossessing of animals. They seem simple, uncomplicated and... to a casual glance, actually quite boring, but there's a lot to krill, actually. They form the largest shoals of any animal on Earth. They can be seen from space, then they're fundamentally important to the entire Southern Ocean ecosystem. Without them, we wouldn't have the incredible whale migrations or the beautiful penguins and so many other things. One thing that they give us is an incredibly powerful enzyme that they have in their bodies, which really helps enormously with some human medical situations. That's one thing that we might not expect to get from krill, but we do. So they're already absolutely paying their way. But the way that krill find their way around, if we're talking about senses, is largely through their chemosense. They smell their way around the world, all the way around the Antarctic continent. And, you know, our sense of smell is, we often think of it as being a relatively minor or very reduced sense, but it's fundamentally important to the quality of our lives too. I mean, we don't necessarily navigate all the way around Antarctica with it, but it's really important to our lives. Smell is one of the most difficult senses to get a grip of. Now, we can measure colour, we can put a number on colour, and we can compare it in a relatively objective way between ourselves. Hearing, we can easily measure the volume of a sound and the pitch of a sound. When it comes to smell, however, things are so much less clear, at least from a scientific measuring perspective, because our sense of smell is really a mix, or our sensation of smell is a real mix of different volatile chemicals that all come together in this kind of blend, which gives us a singular perception. So let's take coffee, for example. The vast majority of us love the smell of coffee, especially first thing in the morning. And we think of coffee as a smell, and yet coffee is actually a mix, a medley of 700 or so different volatile chemicals, which all come together. Your brain sort of computes the relative input of all of these 700 different separate ingredients and gives you that idea of coffee. But there is no one smell of coffee. There are many different things in there. And actually, the really interesting thing is that when people's sense of smell gets dialed up to the max and becomes really sensitive, and this happens, for instance, when people get pregnant, their sense of smell becomes so sensitive that they start to notice single elements within that 700 chemical mix, one of which, for instance, is indole, a chemical called indole. Now, we wouldn't normally smell it, and that's a good thing because actually indole smells pretty foul. But when people are pregnant, the smell of indole comes right to the fore and makes coffee smell, for some people in pregnancy, makes coffee smell actually quite awful. So it's only when we see these sort of exceptions that we start to realize the complexity of of chemicals, and that's really of chemical smells, and that's what Alexander Graham Bell was talking about. He was looking for some kind of means of measuring smell, and we're still some way off that, even now, 100 years on.
Companies make billions out of bottling smells, but their effects, what do we know? And their efficacy in our lives, it's elusive. Can you expand
Absolutely.
On that?
Obviously, the cosmetics industry, perfume industry, are huge, huge moneymakers. We want to sort of play around with our own sort of chemical signature, make ourselves smell nicer to others. And that of course, creates this market for companies to fill with their products. Again, a little bit like the coffee example, there are some things inside many perfumes which on their own would smell pretty terrible, but in a mix give sort of depth and fascinating qualities to the smell of a perfume. Things like castoreum. Often the things that perfumers put in their perfumes are things taken from the unspeakable ends of animals, from certain glands and things like that, which on their own we wouldn't think of daubing on ourselves, but within a perfume actually bring out some kind of warmth and depth that even if we can't sense it on its own, you know, really, really help the overall message that the perfume kind of conveys. And actually, marketers are increasingly getting interested in the idea of using smell to, well, let's not put too fine a point on it, to manipulate human behavior. So we know that, for instance, people, the one experiment was with people in casinos. When the casino smelled of a fresh lemony smell, people stayed longer and bet more. That's one example. Of course, we've all heard the sort of canard about, you know, if you make your house smell of baking bread when you're showing people around and you want to try and sell your house, that smell of baking bread seems to put people in a pleasant mood and perhaps makes them more likely to buy your house. I'm not sure.
I've heard that about cinnamon too.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that wouldn't work with me because I love cinnamon, but we're all different, eh?
We are indeed. And we know about bad smells warning us, but most of us don't know a lot more than that.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, we often think about our senses as being sort of a conduit to pleasure, sort of making us feel great about the world and all sorts of things. But actually, our senses really evolved to keep us out of danger. So taste is all about keeping poisons out of the body, primarily. That's its first function. Its second function is to help us find food that's good to eat. But our sense of smell keeps us away from disease or danger and things like that. Sight, obviously, in many animals, and including in our forebears, was all about spotting the approach of something with sharp teeth with a hungry look in its eye. So, yeah, our senses really start out really as a means to keep us out of harm's way and only secondarily give us pleasure.
Let's talk about taste. Is it the same with taste as well?
Absolutely, yeah. So we can measure taste in a way which is much more clear than its sort of cousin sense, which is of smell. We know that we can see our sensitivity to certain fundamental, if you like, primary tastes, sweetness, saltiness, umami, and so on. And the thing that our taste buds, our taste sensation is most attuned to, weirdly enough, is bitterness. It's, you know, orders of magnitude more sensitive to bitterness than it is to sweetness. And the reason for that is that lots of chemicals in plants that plants use to defend themselves against herbivores and grazing animals are alkaloids. Alkaline chemicals, in other words. Alkaline things taste bitter. So our ability to detect bitterness and the ability of dozens, I mean, plenty of other animals, is all about basically avoiding poisonous things. So if you were to put something that's very bitter in your mouth, whether it be poisonous or not, you'll immediately notice it. And actually, there's a patch of extreme, exquisite sensitivity to bitterness right at the back of your tongue. I should just interject that the tongue map that we all learned at school is not true, but nevertheless, there is a patch at the back of the tongue which is really sensitive to bitterness. So if you so far forget yourself to be chewing something that's really bitter and poisonous, and it gets towards the point where you're about to swallow it, it goes to the back of your mouth, and this patch will most likely be the sort of last resort and will cause you to reject that and perhaps spit it out before you swallow it and perhaps do yourself harm.
Okay, let's come back to smell. With bad smells, it's not just repugnance, but we draw other emotional conclusions from bad smells.
Yeah, we do. Well, I mean, that's the wonder of the human mind, I suppose, isn't it? You know, we draw links between sensations and experiences. That's one thing. But there were some really interesting, if kind of horrible, experiments that have been done over the years where people have been tested for their opinions and their sort of feelings in regards to certain controversial topics. I'm thinking here of immigration, relations between people within society and that sort of thing. So, they're given a questionnaire about their responses to these sorts of things. But in some of these experiments, these have been done under two sort of what we call treatments. One of those treatments is a control treatment, so there's no real smell in the room where people are asked to fill in this questionnaire. But the other treatment, fascinatingly, has been made to smell foul. And actually, what they seem to use in some of these experiments is a fart spray. So they make the room smell pretty awful, but the experimenters don't comment on that whatsoever. They just, you know, hand the questionnaires out and the people fill it in. But that background awful smell really seems to change people's opinions, or at least to take their existing opinions and to make them more harsh, more strident, so that people become less accepting, less sort of less socially inclined, less accepting of others, particularly in minority groups, under those conditions, which I just think is fascinating. They're not even aware of it either. That's the other thing. This is going on in the subconscious. It just really shows you the extent to which, you know, our senses, smell in this case, really can steer our behaviour without us even perhaps knowing.
Sensational covers a lot of ground, and
sure
I want to go or share with listeners just the variety. So let's go here. Why do women probably have a better sense of smell than men?
Well, women have a better sense of pretty much everything than men, actually. It's not just smell. But in the particular relation to smell, we don't know the answer for certain. So I'll start off by saying that. But it seems most likely that the enhanced sense of smell that women tend to have is all about the fact that women carry young during pregnancy. And at that time, the fetus is incredibly vulnerable to any kind of, you know, outside nasties, chemicals, poisons, and so on. And so this enhanced sort of sensory safeguarding that comes through an improved sense of smell is essential for the developing fetus. Women do tend, on average, to have a slightly better sense of smell than men for that reason.
Has the iPhone changed how we touch?
Well, yes, it has. I mean, actually, pretty much everything changes how we touch because your brain is such a wonderfully flexible organ. But in particular relation to the iPhone, you know, you think about sort of 20, 30 years ago, before people were using smartphones on any kind of regular basis, they would use their hands very, very differently to the way that the generation that has grown up with iPhones uses their hands now. So that kind of swiping, texting, the engagement of, let's say, thumbs in tapping out messages and so on, their brains respond to this by upregulating the amount of brain tissue that they give to the sort of thumb sensitivity. So the brain changes and morphs to, you know, better allow those people who are using their smartphones for texting and swiping and what have you to be more dexterous at it. So that's what's behind that.
You write in the book, sound is the vocabulary of nature. So is it a language that we will be able to decipher more and more?
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the best examples of that, I think, is it was an inventive experiment and an unusual one that looked at when animals make distress calls. Now, you know, we can't speak cow, we can't speak squirrel, but we can recognize the distress calls of these animals. Now, perhaps not surprising in the case of something that's relatively close to us, another mammal, let's say, like a cow or a squirrel in those examples. But actually, if you go right through the animal kingdom, all the way down to and including tree frogs, we can understand and interpret a distress call in all of these animals. We can tell when they're distressed. So in some senses, you know, we do have a slightly shared frame of reference in terms of sounds with so many of those other animals.
You're based in Sydney as the Professor in Animal Behaviour at the University of Sydney. With speech, we think Australians say fish and chips, and they think New Zealanders say fush and chops. How does that happen?
So I guess these are sort of cultural norms which are not enforced on us, but we like to fit in as human beings. We're an intensely social species, and so we tend to mimic the vowel sound in those cases that we hear around us. We don't just pick up the language, we pick up the way of saying things. So you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not a Sydney local. I grew up in the north of England, so my vowels are flat. And in fact, Americans have enormous difficulty working out what on earth I'm saying. So I obviously fitted into my social background as I grew up. And actually, I seem to have picked up absolutely zero of an Australian accent. But yeah, I love the different sounds that come across from Australia and from New Zealand. It's all part of a wonderful mix. Oddly enough, the only people who think I do sound Australian are Canadians, who always guess that I'm Australian, so who knows?
RNZ National, it's Sunday morning. I'm Susanna Leigh-Atawa, speaking with Dr. Ashley Ward about his new book, Sensational. Now, a bird can look dull and brown or grey in its colour to us, but another bird sees riotous colours, and a reindeer can literally see which trees wolves have urinated on. So even creatures that surround us, like cats and rats and dogs and sparrows, can perceive far more than us.
Absolutely. The other thing is, you know, I mean, this gives us an idea that, you know, what we see, what we perceive more generally with our senses, isn't necessarily how the world is. Each different animal has its own experience of the world. And actually, each person has a slightly different experience of the world. There's a huge overlap between us, but there are significant differences. What we're talking about with birds is that they can see into the ultraviolet spectrum. And that means that their perception of colours, as far as we can tell, and we have to use computer vision to study this, what they see is radically different from what we see. So, as you say, a bird that may look relatively plain to us is an absolute riot of colour to another bird of its own species, because they see colours differently. They see in a part of the visual spectrum that we don't. And as you say, reindeer too, particularly in winter, when the entire world for them is pretty much white, they become highly sensitive in their own way to ultraviolet signals. So they can see patches of lichen that they on the ground that seem to, again, using computer vision, that seem to glow under UV. Or, as you say, they can spot the approach of wolves, which is kind of helpful if you're a reindeer. So, yeah, every animal sees the world differently, and every person sees the world slightly differently to every other person.
Staying with sight, you write about the colour of tea in a teacup, that it's harder to tell the colour if the cup is dark on the inside. Is that right?
Yeah. So somebody once said that we judge colours by the company they keep. And there are lots of different examples of this. I mean, there was that internet meme, wasn't there, a few years ago, where people were guessing whether the dress in a picture was, I think, was it blue or gold? And people argue about this. And essentially what that's all to do with is not just the slight differences in people's perception, but the way that the background to draw out the colours of the foreground. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely, our senses are utterly subjective. So our experience of them is also subjective. There's not a great deal of objective truth there. So how we perceive things not only depends on the immediate environment and the context and, say, the colours of other things, but the mood that we're in. You know, I include this story about my grandparents. They only left England once in their entire life, and that was, in my granddad's case, under duress. They went to Vienna. My grandma always wanted to go and see the place where the waltzes came from, and to try and eat some sachetort and things like that. And they got to Vienna, they rounded the building and came face to face with the Danube. And my grandma was apparently incredibly excited by this. She was just thrilled to see the famous river. And in her excitement, she said, "Look, Jim, the Danube. They say if you're in love, it looks blue." My granddad was not a man who was easily stirred by things like that. He said in his very flat Yorkshire accent, "Looks bloody brown to me." So, yeah, it depends on your sort of emotional engagement as well, what colours you see as well. Not that you're necessarily going to see the Danube as being beautiful and blue and things, but still, there is an element of truth to it. When you first fall in love, the world seems like a more colourful, more exciting, more melodious and even nicer smelling world, you know? It's so many things go into creating our perception of the world around us.
Can you just confirm that they did go home together?
I think she was used to him by then, yeah. he had other qualities.
Now, I've heard this said before, and it's great to be having this conversation with you, because I'm hoping that you can confirm either way the link between where dogs poo and geomagnetic fields. Yes or no?
So, yes, I remember I was in a lecture theatre in Prague some years ago listening to a researcher called Heinek Berde, this guy who looks more or less exactly like Santa Claus, I think. And he was explaining his life's research work in the field of animal geomagnetism. And he explained this one study which won him a prize called an Ig Nobel Prize, which sort of reflects the fact that the research is, let's say, a little bit out there. He had volunteers go to local parks and watch dogs as they went to the toilet. Now, I'm still not sure that the explanation that I'll give will make it sound any more reasonable or plausible, but still, they watched hundreds of dogs taking a poo in these various parks. And what they found was that the dogs lined themselves on the Earth's north-south axis. It didn't matter whether their nose was in the north and their bum was in the south, or their nose in the south and their bum in the north. But the dogs lined up along the north-south axis of the Earth to do their business. Not perfectly, because behavioral data is always noisy, but to a far, far greater degree than you would ever predict by chance. Why on earth they do this, what possible advantage there is to it, who knows? We immediately thought, there must be some kind of, there must be some reason to do with, let's say, the prevailing wind or the sun or something like that. But he assured us that he'd allowed for all of those possible explanations, and still, the dogs lined up north-south. Who knew?
If after reading your book we start to think more and more about the arbitrary nature of our own perception of the world, does that make us less sure of ourselves? What effect does that have on us? What are your thoughts? What's your experience, Ashley?
That's an incredibly important question, a really good question, because, we go about our day-to-day lives and we take the colours we see, the things we smell, as objective truth to ourselves, and we understand that's the way that we navigate our whole existence, is through these sights and sounds and smells and tastes and so on. We understand the universe through our senses, and yet the most challenging thing to try and appreciate is that actually, in a real sense, colour doesn't exist. There is nothing. There is no such thing as red. All we have is light that's with a wavelength of around 600-700 nanometers. It's difficult to explain, but really a lot of the things that we experience as real things aren't actually real. But to go too far down that path would leave us, I think potentially it would leave us feeling all the poorer for it, in a sense, and also confused. So, that can be really challenging for people to accept, and really for their day-to-day lives, it doesn't so much matter, except in the sense that somebody else's perception is just as valid as our own. I've seen people argue, let's say, over the colour of an object. There is no absolute truth there.
Dr. Ashley Ward, Professor of Animal Behaviour at the University of Sydney, speaking about his latest book called Sensational.